This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is it possible we could be organic, solar-powered humans and still destroy the ecology of the world? Is there an inner destructive force we need to examine and change in order to evolve or perhaps even to survive? I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. Ashoka Bandaraji is the author of the new book, Sustainability and Well-Being, The Middle Path to Environment, Society, and the Economy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Ashoka Bandaraji is a Yale PhD. She's the author of numerous publications in the field of global political economy, environment, population, and women's studies. She's a college professor and has taught at Brandeis, Mount Holyoke, Georgetown, American, and other universities. Our guest takes us from the early stages of collapse into a different path, the middle path. Ashoka, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, I said the early stages of collapse because for most of us, maybe except for the billion people living in extreme poverty, real collapse has not yet come. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree because, you know, we are still believing that the status quo can continue and that we can succeed within the established institutions and the worldview.
And what systems do you think, though, are approaching collapse?
Well, certainly the environment, you know, there's all this data on climate change and global warming and its impact on communities across the world and the increasing numbers of environmental refugees, people who have been displaced due to disasters associated with climate change. There's also biodiversity loss that is rampant, and then chemical pollution. And I think that in the industrialized North, people are not so aware of the acuteness of these crises in many other parts of the world. For example, the use of chemical pesticides in agriculture and how that's leading to chronic kidney disease and other health problems in agricultural communities, for example.
Well, I would add to your list also the economy because the banking crisis and the way the high unemployment, there's a lot of problems there too. Well, now we have a system of giant banks and corporations and military organizations that seem to be taking us outside the planet's ability to support us, and yet these same institutions insist they are the only way. How would you describe this mode of thinking?
I think that the dominant worldview is that we can create a reality that is a market-based and technology-based reality which sees humanity and the natural environment as resources to be used and almost as dispensable entities, when in fact we need to see things from an ecological perspective where we as human beings, and certainly the economic system, which is a subsystem of a society, are embedded within this larger reality of the ecosystem and the environment. And we need to take an ecological perspective rather than this sort of mechanistic and market-based perspective, which is dominating and increasingly becoming the dominant approach to life, so much so that, you know, we are talking about sort of bioengineering, biotechnology, creating new species, transhuman species, that is merging humans with machines and life as created in laboratories, you know, not just plants and animals, but increasingly human life itself. And that, of course, is the extreme, but that is the direction in which we are moving. Which is not to say that technology and the market don't have their place. And in fact, there are certain groups of people, particularly those who underconsume, who are in poverty-stricken situations, who need to consume more. And I think we need to have a middle path where there is more balance between the underconsumption of certain groups and the hyper-consumerism of certain other groups. And also in terms of technology, having a more balanced approach to technology, renewable sources of energy and alternatives to chemical pesticides, so on and so forth.
Yes, a less harmful technology, but still we can be smart about it. Now, in the legend of your namesake, the Emperor Ashoka, the supreme ruler, came to a recognition point and began social change to benefit all. Now, I personally doubt the most powerful groups in our time show any signs of making that transition. And if they don't, where does our hope come from?
I think it comes from professionals and middle-class people and educating people and consciousness, because the systems that we have in place are the products of human consciousness and thinking. And I think that people need to realize, and I think more and more individuals are realizing, that it is a very destructive path that we are on, a suicidal path, and rather than identifying with it in a very individualistic, competitive way that somehow we can survive in it, even if the environment is collapsing all around us and human societies are collapsing, rather to sort of really exercise our own power and try to take more leadership and provide direction. And I think in doing that, we also have to think about intergenerational justice. We have to think about the generations down the road. And that's where sort of a Native American thinking, for example, seventh generation sustainability, making decisions, taking into account the well-being of seven generations to come. And I think in this transformation of consciousness and social change, the so-called middle groups, professionals, intellectuals, have a very important role to play, because those who are at the very bottom are just trying to survive from day to day. They have hardly anything to eat, no shelter, no health care, so on and so forth. But those groups in the middle, rather than trying to identify with the 1%, so to speak, I think need to exercise their freedom of expression and really take a broad look at, you know, where we are headed, which means we have to really emphasize interdependence, because I think that is the one thing that I emphasize mostly in the book, that the problem is not even globalization or capitalism or communism as much as dualism. That is, we think in terms of self versus other rather than thinking in terms of interdependence, our connection with each other and the connectedness to nature, that we are in fact part of nature rather than separate from it.
Well, Ashoka Bandaraji, you draw from the tradition of Buddhism. Is it possible to reduce our mental suffering and still be activists working for change?
Absolutely, because being on a spiritual path, if you want to put it that way, is not sitting on a cushion meditating. While, you know, that is increasingly important, that kind of sort of inner reflection and inner development is essential. But also, how do we practice that on an ongoing basis in terms of our relationships to each other and how we live in the world? So Buddhism has, and I think many other spiritual traditions, have never been just about ritual or sort of individual self-advancement. I think it is about the community and our relationships to each other. So in that sense, the psychosocial transformation that I talk about in the book needs to be emphasized.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is author, scholar, and journalist Ashoka Bandaraji. Ashoka, in your book, Sustainability and Well-Being, you suggest our social movements are not enough and not working in the right directions. What is the problem?
Well, I have looked at environmental movements and social justice movements, and there is a historical tradition of these movements not always working together. And I, for example, give the case of ecofascism, where certain green movements, while they have upheld environmental sustainability, have actually worked against social justice and have stood not only for discrimination, but even genocide of certain groups. Just take the example of Nazi ecofascism. So I think it's important to bring these movements together, and certainly there are many movements trying to do so. But I think it is an environmental justice movement, particularly given the fact that it is people of color, people in the South, and poor communities who bear the brunt of environmental destruction more than privileged groups, although when it comes to environmental collapse, you know, it affects us all.
Well, before we return to the nagging problem of our destructive inner dialogue, I'm wondering if we can ground this a little bit in your own country of Sri Lanka. I know you are very familiar with the West, having taught in several American universities, but we know little to nothing about Sri Lanka other than it's near India, it was called Ceylon, and suffered both a tsunami and a civil war. Why not tell us how Western chemical companies affect the lives of the poorest people of Sri Lanka?
Yes, I'm glad you're raising that question because, you know, the tsunami and the civil war have received global attention, but things like chronic kidney disease that is rampant, widespread among agricultural communities, particularly in the north central province and in Sri Lanka, is really little known outside of the country. And very large percentages of the agricultural population, farmers, have been affected by kidney disease, and even the WHO, the World Health Organization, has attributed the chronic kidney disease to widespread use of chemical pesticides, you know, agrochemicals. And studying this issue, I found that this is not a problem peculiar to Sri Lanka, that in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua, and also the agricultural areas of India, that there is also similar cases of kidney disease that are suspected to be linked to widespread use of pesticides. And oftentimes these pesticides are things that have been banned in the industrialized north, and it is the poor, again, you know, who are mostly victimized by such diseases. But on the other hand, you know, the food and the products that create, you know, get circulated across the world, and certainly through the global economic trade and the ecosystem, it also comes back to the north. So again, you know, there is that interconnectedness of these environmental and public health issues.
And you've brought us back to the big picture. Now, various Western authors say our habit of domination began with agriculture and civilizations of the ancient Middle East. Those cultures damaged their environment, while native Indian cultures in the Americas apparently did not. Where in that picture does the ancient Asian culture fit into this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sort of generalize, you know, across Asia. For example, in Sri Lanka, there was a hydraulic civilization prior to European colonialism. People who have studied this, including some of my colleagues, have pointed out that the irrigational systems that were used at that time were actually more sustainable than the kinds of new irrigational infrastructure that have been introduced through World Bank and other Western-funded organizations that have involved, you know, massive dam building and massive infrastructure, displacement of population, so on and so forth. So even there's a lot of lessons to be learned from pre-modern traditions of agriculture and cultivation. And also those systems were not the monocultural crop production like that was introduced by the British with, say, tea plantation. You know, they were more diversified agricultural production, which included, you know, rotating the soil, rotating the different areas that were cultivated with different plants over time, and certainly the use of more natural pesticides.
Well, I'm worried about Sri Lanka because, as we learned from the tsunami, so many people lived right along the coast and depend upon it for their survival. And yet, with rising seas, we're going to see more violent storms and higher waters washing over. I know Sri Lanka is also a very mountainous country. There are places to go, but it's hard to see how your country will adapt to climate change.
Yeah, I'm glad you're raising that issue because just south to Sri Lanka are the Maldives, which are, you know, hundreds of atolls, and they are predicted to go under. And in fact, the Maldivian government has been talking about relocating their entire population elsewhere. And Sri Lanka, too, is an island, and many of the coastal areas have been repopulated again, I mean, the coastal belt. And also the kind of tourism, and although sometimes it's referred to as ecotourism, is also putting a toll on the coastal belt. And I don't think there is, you know, enough attention being given to these looming problems, you know, despite the devastation that was caused by the tsunami a few years ago. And also there is, you know, massive deforestation, and in the name of development, like in many other parts of the world, for example, the elephant population is being wiped out because their homes, the forest is being destroyed.
That makes me very sad to hear that. Now, I would like to get a more concrete grasp on this idea of the middle path for our listeners. We're busy. We want specifics. What can we do with this idea of the middle path?
Yeah, the middle path, I think that when we talk about sustainability and simple living and cutting down on consumption, particularly in the West in terms of meat consumption, people get very scared and they feel threatened. And I think it is important to point out that it is not about going back to our foraging history, where we spent 99% of our lives as human beings, and there was a kind of stasis. There was no material technological development at that time. And I don't think that sustainability calls for that. But on the other hand, sustainability also is not compatible with unbridled growth. I think there's got to be regulation. There's got to be limitations on the kind of technology that we use, limitations on use of fossil fuel, and, you know, limits on consumption. And to get to that point of a middle path, a balance, I think it's about living in balance with nature and not disturbing the natural equilibrium of nature, which is not to say that nature doesn't change, but we are changing nature in such a rapid pace that it is collapsing around us. So I think it is not to say that we should have no growth, like some conservationists and radical environmentalists would say. So I think that is where the middle path comes in. It is not a complete no to growth, but it is a more balanced growth, rational use of resources, and solar technology, wind technology, as opposed to, say, the Keystone Pipeline, for example. So I think that is where it comes in, that it's an alternative to unbridled growth and no growth, but it has to be a much more conscious process, which involves a kind of an inner transformation where we have to ask, what are our needs? And putting more energy in terms of our social development and our inner development, not just the technological and material development.
Well, you've given us a lot of powerful ideas, I think. My guest has been Ashoka Bandaraji, appearing in the Huffington Post and author of at least 5 books. Her latest is Sustainability and Well-Being. If you want to travel outside ideas that are not working, give her book a try. Find her at bandaraji.com, spelled B-A-N-D-A-R-A-G-E. Thank you so much, Ashoka, for joining us.
Thank you, Alex, and keep up the good work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.